Welcome to Foraging, a podcast in environmental humanities. In this series, we invite emerging and confirmed voices in history, anthropology and social sciences to share their ongoing research with us. We want to shed light on how the groundbreaking, critical work challenges anthropocentric biases in the humanities. We want you to get inspired by their experiences, the methods, the conceptual frameworks. And we aim together to explore new ways of doing science and to find hope in the Anthropocene. My name is Benoît Henriet. I am professor of history at the Vrije Universiteit Brussels and the principal investigator of the Foragency project, Foraging, Colonialism and Modern Human Agency in Central Africa. This project is funded by a European Research Council starting grant and is hosted by the research group SHOCK, Social History of Capitalism, at the Vrije Universiteit Brussels. For the second episode of Foraging, I had the pleasure of talking with Kwame Edwin Otu. Kwame is an associate professor in the African Studies program at Georgetown University. Graduated from the University of Ghana before obtaining a PhD in anthropology at Syracuse University. His doctoral research on the Sasso, a community of self-identified effeminate men living in the Jamestown district of Accra, served as the groundwork for his first monograph called Amphibious Subjects, which was published by the University of California Press in 2022. In addition to his scholarly work, Kwame also wrote and performed in a short film Reluctantly Queer in 2016, directed by Akusoa Adoma Owusu. This piece, which tells the story of a young Ghanaian man struggling to reconcile his sexuality with his love for his mother, has been selected in many festivals and won the Best International Short Award at the Baltimore International Black Film Festival. Kwame and I sat together to discuss his ongoing research project, an ethnography of the pickers toiling in one of the world's largest e-waste dumps, which is located on the shores of the Kole Lagoon in Accra. Kwame is currently turning this endeavor into his second book, provisionally titled The Salvage Slot, Technology and the Ecologies of the Afterlife. We talked about how his previous work on queerness informed and shaped his trajectory in environmental anthropology. We also discussed the notion of waste, the daily experience of toxicity and pollution by e-waste pickers, and delved on the ethnographic approaches of non-human entities. I hope that you will enjoy today's conversation as much as I did. Kwame has indeed been a truly inspiring and engaging interlocutor. Kwame, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Benoît.
So maybe just a first question. Can you tell us more about why and how you became an anthropologist?
Oh my goodness. I went to the University of Ghana. That's where I really discovered anthropology. I really never knew that there was a discipline called anthropology, because in Ghana, anthropology is subsumed under sociology. And when I got to the university, I was given sociology, information studies, political science, and history, right? And, in Ghana, the system is such that as you advance in your degree from your first year to your second year to your third year to your fourth year, you drop some of the courses, right? So sociology was very captivating. I was just quite fascinated. It was taught, my first sociology course was taught me by this Catholic priest, Michael Otrefo, who had gotten his PhD in Vienna. And I was just astounded by the sheer amount of vastness of knowledge that sociology produced. I was really more fascinated by the works of Auguste Comte, Emil Durkheim, who else? Max Weber, Karl Marx. These were the early beginnings of my interest in anthropology. I did not know then. And when I got to my fourth year, I made a decision to major in sociology. So I was required to take a course in anthropology, which was taught by Betty Akumate. The course was a two-sequence class. One was taught in the first semester, and the second sequence was taught in the second semester. The first sequence is called Social Anthropology. The second sequence is Societies and Cultures of Africa. And Bertie Akumate, this woman, had actually gone to Cambridge for her master's. She worked with Keith Hart. Keith Hart is known for coining the term informal economy at Cambridge. And the way Bertie taught the course, I was like, oh my goodness, like the scales began to fall off my eyes. And I was suddenly in love with this course. I mean, of course, you know, at the time I knew that anthropology has this colonial baggage that it carried, you know, everything carries a colonial baggage. Like you and I carry colonial baggages, you know. And Betty was really good at helping me think with anthropology as a disciplinary endeavor or technology even to renew conversations on Africa, African studies, you know, how can I harness, right, the potential in this field? I mean, given the fact that it uses ethnography, right, and participant observation, you know, like these for me at the time came off as very democratically useful methods, right? Because anthropology is embedded, the anthropologist, I beg your pardon, is embedded in the community, they are interacting with people, they become a part of the people, I mean, they go native, the native becomes anthropology. So in many ways, these were the motivations that really gestured me in the direction of anthropology and for which I became an anthropologist and for which I thought that if anything at all, despite anthropology being described by the likes of Talal Asad as the handmaiden of colonialism, that anthropology was the most befitting discipline for the study of Ghana, Africa at large, yeah.
Okay. And can you tell us a bit more about how this interest in anthropology led you to do your research for your PhD, which led to the publication in 2022 of your first monograph with the University of California Press, Amphibious Subjects?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So can you tell us more about this research and about queer self-making in neoliberal Ghana?
I will. And, you know, I think anthropology, once again, the anthropologist, there's a difference between a native anthropologist and, well, I hate to use that term, but I'll use it anyways, and an anthropologist from somewhere else, right? And doing anthropology made me a foreigner, right? Doing my ethnography in Ghana actually made me feel like, oh my God, I'm even foreign to my own culture, right? And this became quite self-evident when I started my fieldwork on queer self-making. I mean, I at the time thought, oh, I was all very versed and conversant. You know, no one is ever conversant in their culture. Like this idea of cultural fluency, cultural competency, cultural conversancy, I think is quite fiction, you know, because anthropology taught me that I was really a novice in my own culture. And I think that realization, quite frankly, brought me to the horizon of humility, right? And so coming to terms with, like, entering the field and as okay, when I went to the US, I was not originally going to study queerness, really. I was going to study gender and irrigation management. That was my initial PhD idea or topic. And I came out in 2009, and I was like, what better discipline to be in, to come out to as a queer person? Because anthropology, coming out at the time and discovering this field, allowed me to open myself out, right? Anthropology, like archaeology, right, is an excavation. You are excavating culture, you are excavating yourself. So this moment of coming out coincided with this desire to study queerness in Ghana and why Ghanaians, you know, responded to queer people in the ways in which they did, you know, and you, what that meant, what would it mean for me as a Ghanaian who is newly out, right, to study what it means to be queer in Ghana. And this really sent me down the rabbit hole of discovering Ghana anew. So that in many ways, queerness allowed me to queer Ghana and even queer myself and how I interacted with Ghana. And when I say this, I mean, if I were heterosexual, right, I wouldn't have engaged with Ghana in the ways in which I did, right? Because there was this return to this self that I should always have been, right? That being a compulsory heterosexual had inhumed, had buried, right? And queerness really allows you to bring out, right? It permitted me, give me that permission, albeit nervously, to excavate, to bring out the self, right? And going down this rabbit hole meant that I had to understand Ghana in a different way. That in Ghana, there were different languages, different discourses for people who were queer, and that what I thought as a heterosexual described queer people was far from the truth, right? And so I came to learn about these things from the men I engaged with who were called Sasso. As a native, I did not even know Sasso existed until this ethnography opened this vista, right? It opened this whole new world. It felt like a different universe within Ghana, right? And so that is the moment of humility I'm talking about, that I had to become a child again, right? Begin to learn the language of this community, how they navigated, right, the precarious environments in which they lived as gender non-normative men who also engaged in homoeroticism, right? And this for me was so critical. And, you know, I called it amphibious subjects because I also was interested in how this turned to thinking about Ghana differently, right? Gave me the opportunity to think of African philosophy as one way of thinking and theorizing, right, what it means to be queer in Ghana. So amphibious, the term amphibious, which I use in the book, is indebted to the philosophy of Kwame Jichi, who is a Ghanaian philosopher and had always been talking about self-making, right, amongst Ghanaians, amongst the Ashanti people, amongst the Akan. And he uses the amphibian, you're right, to capture this moving back and forth between the individual and the collective, right? This is what defines the individual. And I was also seeing the same dynamics in the queer community, in the Sasso community, which is that the Sasso were basically oscillating or moving back and forth between being Sasso and being heterosexual, right? These kind of convolutions were fascinating to me, yeah.
Well, I understand. And then what motivated you to move from this anthropology of queerness towards a more environmental anthropology? And how has your work on queerness informed your approach of waste and e-waste pickers as an ethnographic topic, the topic on which you are now working?
You know, good question. I get asked that question all the time and I'm like, oh yeah, I need to make sense, right? Because like, how can you be studying queer bodies and then suddenly you're doing environmental? My answer to that, Benoit, is that we are ecological. Bodies are landscapes, right? Bodies are ecosystems. Bodies are environment, right? So what I say to that is that, like, I was already studying the environment before I studied the environment, right? And here's how. When I did this project, so that my ethnography on queer self-fashioning in Ghana unfolds in a community called Jamestown, right? Jamestown is actually not so far from the central business district of Accra, and it sits on the coast. And because it is on the coast, it's also, it means a majority of the people who live there are actually commercial fishermen, right, called fisher folk. And so not so far from Jamestown was a lagoon called the Collie Lagoon. The Collie Lagoon has become the site for, the deposition of e-waste, right? Ghana now currently, allegedly, has the Africa's largest electronic waste dump, right? And while I was doing my ethnography on queer self-fashioning, I found out that some of the Sasso I engaged with had boyfriends on the e-waste dump, right? You know, who weren't really a part of the demographic that I interviewed for my project, right? But I also thought that, you know, queerness has a way of transforming methodology and also epistemology. I wanted to think at the time about the connections between reproductive waste and productive waste, right? Queer people in Ghana are regarded as waste, right? Because queer people everywhere, quite frankly, within this, you know, infrastructure of racial capitalism, queerness is antithetical to capitalism, right? Because queerness refuses the reproductive capital, right, associated with procreation. If capitalism's goal is to harness the labor potential that humans are endowed with, right, is to mine, right? That's why I'm saying that the body is a landscape. So capitalism is mining this labor out of the landscape of our bodies. What queer people embody is this kind of refusal, right? I mean, I don't want to have children. My queerness does not, I mean, there are some queer people who would like to, right? Good for them. But like, I think queerness in many ways become capitalism antithesis. Right. And so in conversations with the Sasso I interacted with during my first book or in my first book project, they would say that, you know, their families were very disappointed because they were not going to have children. Right. And that made me think about how the use of waste, because my mom would always tell me, so why are you wasting your semen? Why are you wasting your sperm? Aren't you going to have children? Right. And that representation, the deployment of waste in that context, I found fascinating that queer bodies are actually antithetical to capital, they are waste. And so given the fact that the e-waste dump was there and the e-waste workers were also regarded as waste, because these e-waste workers come from northern Ghana, right? And northern Ghanaians are perceived as impoverished. Northern Ghana, if you will, historically was where enslaved people were captured and transported across the Atlantic to the Americas, right? And so there's this legacy of slavery that hovers, right, over the Ghanaian imaginary, where Ghanaians actually racialize the northerners. We call them northerners. But the northern Ghana Benoit is one of the most diverse, it's a complicated, convoluted universe of ethnic groups, much more diverse than the South. But then in the Ghanaian context, we lump them all up together and call them northerners. We don't refer to the southerners as southerners, right? And so I was interested in this connection between reproductive waste connected to the queer body and productive waste connected to this ethnicized, racialized northerner, right? And that is really what married the motivation that became the interest undergirding this project.
Okay. And can you tell us more then about your ethnographic experience, like working in a dump and how you engaged with these e-way speakers as interlocutors?
You know, it's very interesting you say that, because now your question makes me think about what people asked when I was doing my work on queer people. I was asked, why are you studying queer people? Why are you studying these people? Right? I get that a lot with studying waste workers on the dump in Ghana. Why are you studying these people? So again, you are seeing the parallels between these wasted lives. Queer bodies are wasted. Bodies that work on the dump are also wasted, right? I will talk about that a bit later. But like, it's very nostalgic in a very interesting way. Because I was born into Islam. I was born and raised in Medina, right? My parents lived there for a long time until they transitioned to a middle-class neighborhood when I went to college. And so going to the dump, the smell, the pungence, the filth, the dirt, you know, the accumulations of waste, the grit, right? The sweat, the smoke, the fumes. And the fact that these, you know, formations together overwhelm my senses, send me down this memory lane. It reminds me of where I was born and raised, Medina. And I'm also filled with fear because I'm like, oh my God, this is what I used to be. This was my experience. And when I'm there, I feel like I have actually slipped back into this abjection, right? And so when working on the dump with my interlocutors, I'm navigating this anxiety because I'm triggered. This is what I used to be. This is how I was born. This is the environment that produced. This waste environment was what has now produced me, this body, who in this universe is sitting in this studio with you in the middle of Brussels, which is regarded as a refined place. So I've become a refined person, but yet this is my origins, right? And I think that for me, interacting with my interlocutors on this waste dump and being besieged by the smells and feeling this nostalgia, walking down memory lane, right, is really showing me how complex waste is, right? And how we come to embody waste, depending on where we are, who we are, what timeline you are in, what spatial context you are in, right? And when I go back there, I feel like I've traveled into a different timeline. So then imagine the nervousness and the disorientation. But then it's also an orientation because that was my orientation, right? And that is exactly what interacting with these workers teach me. Right, to re-embody, but also disembody this past, this present, and the future. It feels like when I'm there, the timelines congeal. My future self, my present self, and my past self. And that is waste. Waste is that archive of the past, the present, and the future. And the dump really brings that to the fore.
Okay. And what about your interlocutors? How do they speak and how do they make sense of these daily confrontation with waste, toxicity and pollution?
They are very aware, you know. I think that in their own way and in their own registers that they know that this is a very vulnerable place to be, right? But then for them, being vulnerable has multiple meanings. Being vulnerable in Accra, right, is very different from the vulnerability that pushed them here to begin with. Right, they are coming from a place in Ghana, which is called the North, which has historically been extracted from slavery, colonization, and the post-colony, right? So they are aware of the intensity of their vulnerabilities. For them, life every day, right, involves running away from vulnerability into another vulnerability, because that is really what it means to live a wasted life, right? But insofar as they are making ends meet, insofar as they are sending money back to the North, supporting their children, their mothers, their fathers, their wives, their girlfriends, their family members, vulnerability diminishes, right? Because their vulnerability is making someone else somewhere less vulnerable, right? And that is really how that is what for me and for them keeps them, you know, alive and going.
Okay. And beyond the human subjects of your ethnography, I was wondering how, as an anthropologist, you also approach non-humans as an object of research. And for instance, what is the place of the Kole Lagoon that you just mentioned in your own work? How can you or an anthropologist anthropologize a water body?
I mean, you know, before anthropologists anthropologized, I mean, I think Africans anthropologize everything, really. I mean, you know, this whole emergence of interspecies studies, you know, human, non-human, whatever. I'm like, well, you know, when you look at African cosmology, we are already humanizing the natural environment that nourishes us, whatever natural is, right? But then we have this kind of, and I don't mean to romanticize, right? But what I do know is that historically we've had a certain relationship to the environments in which we are embedded, right? That has been quite different from, you know, how Western contexts, you know, engage with the environment. And so when you go to the dump, right, there are cows, cattle, chickens, sheep, lambs, you know, these all over the place. These cattle are the cattle that some of the people would kill during slaughter, during Eid, because majority of the people who work on the dumps are Muslim too. So we even have to think about the Islamophobia, right, that, yeah, it's connected. But, you know, and so there is a relationship between the people and the space, right, that mimics, quite frankly, how Ghanaian society relates to these people, right? And so what I'm trying to say is that the lagoon historically used to be a spiritual site for the traditional Ghana people, right? This little geography, this ecology, this aquatic habitat, right, was really the residence for the Ghana gods and goddesses. And then the British, upon arriving, right, through their various projects and in their bid to fight against malaria, decided to convert the lagoon to a kind of marina, right, where, you know, to just to control malaria. And so this re-territorialization of the dump, right, leads to a different relationship, which is what we are contending with right now, right? So as an anthropologist, I've always been interested in these histories, like how the Ghana's related to this place, but then how this secret place has suddenly become this filthy place, like this waste, this place that used to be a site of, you know, spiritual edification, if you will, has suddenly become a place where nobody wants to go back to this waste subjects, right? So there are certain ways in which, like, I think of this particular environment as really embodying the state of Ghana, right? That you can look at the lagoon and then see Ghana and the Ghanaian people. And when I say the Ghanaian people, I don't mean those who have wealth, you know, those who are in the helm of power, but the Ghanaian masses. The lagoon is an archive that documents, right? And by saying that, Benoit, I'm trying to say that I'm putting the lagoon first, that to understand the state of immiseration and suffering a people go through, you have to look at their ecologies. And that if the lagoon is an ecology of resignation and immiseration, then it should tell you, right, the lives of the people. I don't want to put humans first. Mm-hmm. I want to put the ecology first, because the ecology is a record, right? The ecology is a record of the state of life of the people.
It It's also very interesting because you mentioned the different lives and perceptions of the Corley Lagoon as a place, you know, a current toxic receptacle of late capitalist waste, but also a place that is or has been laden with spiritual meanings, a place that is also deeply connected to the traumas of slavery and of colonialism, and also, what you mentioned in some of your writing, a current point of engagement for neoliberal restoration initiatives. So I was wondering, as an anthropologist, how does the long history of this place kind of inform your own research and how you build a bridge between the past and the present?
Oh, well, absolutely. You know, I think you know the answer to this question, but I'm going to just basically say that, I think history is there to remind me of how we got here, right? But also not where we are going, but where we don't know we are going. Because I don't know where we are going, right? Because do you think that if we knew we're going to get here, we would get here. We would like to get here. If we knew 10 years ago that we would be here in this dispensation that is so messy, that is extractive, that is violent, that is... Do you think we would like to be here? Exactly, right. So I think we need to think of history as telling us that, well, we don't know where we are going. We should just come to terms with that uncertainty. History should lay the foundations for uncertainty. And that is what this ecology has taught me, right? That whatever spoils, whatever plunder that this ecology, this space, the people who animated express to me, right? Tell me that history is really such a contentious thing to rely on, right? And that when I'm using it, I shouldn't use it in all certainty, right? And that on being uncertain, not knowing the future, the unknowable future, is perhaps the only future to endow your energy in. Because knowing the future, right, is a colonial thing. We can't control, right? And if anything at all, as an anthropologist, when I enter this project, is that, like, I know the neoliberal restoration is going to fail because we think we are in control of the situation, but we are not. And if anything at all, that is what history has actually, that is the gift history has endowed us with, yet we are refusing to, you know, take it seriously because we always want to know. We always want to keep digging. Extraction. And extraction is going to lead us nowhere, clearly.
This kind of bridges nicely towards the final question that I had for you, which is related mostly to what we can still hope for the future to a certain extent, because we have been facing this, you know, increase of research in human and social sciences on the Anthropocene, on late capitalism and its toxic legacy, people doing fascinating ethnographies of dumps, of oil rigs, of mines, of cash crop plantations. And they help us a lot understanding the current state of current messy state of the planet, but they often offer very little solutions or ways forward to think of ways to cope with the current and the future state of the world. And I was wondering what you thought about this, and if you think that there's still some hope to be found in the Anthropocene, and if, you know, research can kind of help us make sense and find a footing in this current situation.
Why do we always end on those notes, you know, like, because I think, you know, I am hopeful and not hopeful, right? Because that is where I resign myself, right? Is to, again, know the unknowable, right? So knowing that the future is unknowable is a form of knowledge. It's a form of knowability, right? And so hoping that there's no, like, being aware, you know, it's a form of hope, if you will. But like, knowing that hopelessness is really part of this human paradigm we have become a part of, right? I think that the Anthropocene, the conversations that have been unfolding in the in that particular interdisciplinary context, right? I was a little bit skeptical before because I thought that the Anthropocene had its the ways in which it is divorced from from below, right? And we are still talking about people in the Anthropocene, right? Like the men I work with, people whose lives are on the brink of capitalism, right? Who are falling over that brink, who are actually dying in fumes, right? Whose lives are cut short, right? We are not talking about theory. We are talking about bodies, right? That are literally teetering on this brink. And I feel like some of these conversations on the environment tend to be too disembodied, you know, although we are talking about material, tactile, embodied stuff, right? And I would want to see, right, more listening, right, to those who are not intellectuals like us, but then are also grappling with the very questions as intellectuals are grappling with in a different way. And that they have, before the term Anthropocene was even coined, they were already forewarning us, indigenous people, you know, those who have no degrees, already were telling us that, listen, accumulation is not the way to go, right? This economy, this market economy, this, like, we cannot keep on going this way. Capitalism has to go. Like, because capitalism, if capitalism goes, racism is gone, sexism is gone, homophobia is gone. Right. So in my own work, like towards the end, so I'm still trying to imagine the scaffold, right, for this book. I'm really interested in decumulation as a conversation that has to happen, that we need to begin to focus on, you know, creating economies of decumulation, economies that make us want less, which would require a rewiring of our own habits, our habituses. Are we ready to do that? Right. And I think that focusing or by turning our attention to economics that, you know, unsettles the current hegemonic way of practicing consumption and accumulating, right, that we will be able to begin a process that would allow us to cultivate what I would like to call a regenerative citizenship. And when I say regenerative citizenship, it's that kind of citizenship that actually re-embeds us into this thing, rather than actually suspending ourselves over, pretending we are over, we are dominant, right? That we need to really resurrect whatever prior interactions. We need to go back into the earth, right? And by going back into the earth, we can be able to identify how to live better with it, right? Not how to extract from it, right? And so that is that if we are able to reorient our desires into embracing this decumulative style, right? Rather than accumulate, buy something every day, buy something every week, you know. And so what this also means is that, like, we need to really change how geopolitics, the current infrastructure of the nation state is not ready to enforce and economics of decumulation, because the nation state is really an accumulating, a polity of accumulation. So maybe we also need to, as we are having this conversation for the future, rethink forms of community building, right? But ones that are actually, you know, we need to create regenerative states. If we are thinking about regenerative citizenship, decumulative economics, then we need to think about regenerative states, states that would allow for the, articulation of regenerative citizenship, right? So I think these are the kind, that's what I'm hoping for, that if it happens, how it would happen, I do not know, but it's my dream. It really is my dream.
Thank you so much, Kwame. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Foraging. This episode has been recorded and edited by Yorgos Patsis. I would like to thank the Foragency team members for their contributions, Thijs Kosters, Etienne Gontard, Alice Vittoria, and Peter Lamberts, as well as the Shock Research Group and the Vrije Universiteit Brussel. Foraging is made possible thanks to the European Research Council funding of the Foragency project. We hope that you enjoyed this episode and that you will join us soon for further conversations.